From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are now 8 weeks until Election Day, although ballots are already going out in some places, including North Carolina, where President Trump is campaigning today. Joe Biden will travel to Michigan and Pennsylvania to campaign later this week. Asma Khalid joins us now, NPR national political correspondent, covering the campaigns. And Asma, the potential for a coronavirus vaccine in the coming months has become a campaign issue. President Trump is demanding that Kamala Harris apologize for indicating in a CNN interview over the weekend that she might not take a coronavirus vaccine that President Trump says could be ready by Election Day. Listen.
I will say that I would not trust Donald Trump, and it would have to be a credible source of information that talks about the efficacy and the reliability of whatever he's talking about.
But then yesterday, Joe Biden said he'd take the vaccine if it becomes available. Here he is.
If I could get a vaccine tomorrow, I'd do it. If it cost me the election, I'd do it. We need a vaccine, and we need it now.
We need a vaccine, and we need it now. Asma, it sounds kind of like a mixed message there. Tell us about the vaccine politics.
Well, I will say, Jeremy, I think that both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been pretty clear in saying that, you know, beyond the rhetoric they've been hearing from the president, they really want to make sure that scientific experts are transparent about the efficacy of this vaccine. And last week, Biden himself made some remarks where he said, you know, God willing, when we get a vaccine, that's good. But he questioned, when we get a vaccine, do we think the public is going to line up willing to take this injection? Because he feels like the public has lost confidence in what's being said by the Trump administration. So I will say, I think that they're both calling for this idea that, is there really going to be public buy-in for large-scale administering of this vaccine? And a lot of this, Jeremy, goes back to the fact that for months, Biden has been saying that he feels like the Trump administration needed to be clear about how it was planning to have a widespread plan to actually get people to take this vaccine. And it comes back to the fact that for months, they feel like the Trump administration has been contradictory their own scientific experts, that the president has often at times been giving some advice scientifically that is not really backed up by his own scientific experts. And so will people actually believe what the president says about this? You know, for his part, though, Jeremy, the Trump administration and President Trump has tried to portray these comments as being ones that are spreading fear. They feel like they are fueling, they say, anti-vaxxer conspiracy theories. I will say, you know, historically, both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been supportive of vaccines. Their comments are they don't feel like the public will necessarily buy into what the president's saying. And you look at public polling and the president's handling of the pandemic, it's less than half of the public who believes that he's done a good job.
There have been some other issues that have come up on the campaign trail. And in fact, both of the vice presidential nominees were in Wisconsin yesterday. Kamala Harris made her first solo campaign trip, meeting with union members and black business leaders. Mike Pence spoke to power company workers. Here he is.
And when this president stands up every day and fights for American workers and jobs, 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 we stand with President Donald Trump.
So going back to the jobs, jobs, jobs message that was very, you know, common in the Trump campaign before so many millions of jobs were lost. Where are the campaigns going to concentrate their efforts, do you think, in the next few weeks? What are the states that each side is focused on?
Well, the Biden campaign has been focusing quite a bit on the Midwest, some states that the Democrats lost in 2016 that historically they've won. And I'm thinking of a state like Wisconsin and also Michigan, where Biden himself will be traveling later this week, as well as Pennsylvania. But I will say that Donald Trump, I think, has a much sort of wider cast of states that they're very much interested in. He intends to visit Nevada. Both the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign are also paying a lot of attention to Florida. That's a state that Kamala Harris will be visiting later this week. And it's always a really key battleground state with, you know, 29 electoral votes at stake.
And what do we know about the financial resources on each side? Because we're seeing today that President Trump is saying he'd be willing to spend his own money if he has to on his campaign. Does that mean his campaign doesn't have enough money on its own?
You know, Jeremy, what I will say is that usually a campaign releases their own, fundraising numbers for the month. And what's notable is that for the month of August, we have not gotten any of those independent numbers from the Trump campaign. We did get them from Joe Biden, who announced that between his campaign and the Democratic National Committee, they raised over $360 million, which was a one-month record haul. And it's notable for a candidate who, you know, throughout the primaries, he really struggled to raise a lot of money. If you look back at July, both the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign were essentially tied for cash on hand, which is unusual because the incumbent is expected to have some financial advantages.
Sometimes interesting what you don't find out from the campaigns. Asma Khalid, NPR national political correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the president talked about his relationship with the military during his Labor Day press conference after again denying that story in The Atlantic, corroborated by other outlets that quoted President Trump calling fallen service members losers and suckers. The president said he treats the troops better than former Vice President Joe Biden did. Biden, Trump said, sent them to fight endless wars.
It's one of the reasons the military, I'm not saying the military is in love with me, the soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy.
Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, just start with some context here. The president's critics say he was calling generals war profiteers. What did you hear?
Yeah, I heard echoes of that. He's trying to explain the comments that were reported on in The Atlantic by saying this isn't about his comments about soldiers so much as an opposition that exists toward military officials who want war, and he's presenting himself as someone who doesn't. And I think that's the message he was trying to send.
Well, and the president and his supporters say just that, that he was presenting himself as almost an Eisenhower figure. President Trump tweeted that out, referring to what President Dwight Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, said in his farewell address in 1961. Let's listen to a little.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Now, was Trump also warning against what became known as the vast military-industrial complex? Are they the same?
I think you have to put the words in context. Look, Eisenhower was a military hero, so he spoke with great reverence for the soldiers who fight for the country. He spent his entire second term before that speech actually fighting against defense spending and trying to cut the defense budget so there wasn't much waste. It wasn't just a comment he made at the end of his presidency. And it was a kind of thought through, systematic idea about how the military should be structured. Again, what we're talking about with President Trump are comments about soldiers, not really about the military. And his record has no evidence that he cares about how military spending happens, just the opposite. He kind of likes the status quo.
Well, let's talk about that, because people are saying that even if he was trying to bask in some of Eisenhower's glory, Eisenhower warning against what this huge industry that was growing up around the military, not saying it was the generals who were unleashing war to profit from it, but saying that the industry was trying to co-opt it, that President Trump is actually someone who's been pushing arms sales, along with aides like Peter Navarro. They pushed arms sales to Saudi Arabia for use in the war in Yemen. It's been reported that Navarro worked to lobby reluctant lawmakers to support those sales, which continue. The president's Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, is a former defense contractor lobbyist. He worked for Raytheon. It's kind of blatantly hypocritical.
Right. I mean, often what you have to do with President Trump is just look at the record, his own record, before we evaluate what he has to say. And his record is not one where he spent much time, as President Eisenhower did, after actually going after these problems. And from Secretary Esper, to comments President Trump has made boasting of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, it seems more clear that he's okay with the military-industrial complex, if that's what we're going to call it. And this is just a convenient way to try to get out of what The Atlantic has reported.
Well, Julian, is there any precedent for this? This driving a wedge, actually, in that comment between the troops and their generals, dissing their generals in that statement. And then the Atlantic story. Even a Fox News reporter is confirming that the president made those comments about troops. Is there any other president in history who said these things about the military?
Well, there's presidents who have had a lot of tension with military leaders. Harry Truman, as president, had immense tension with Douglas MacArthur over the strategy in Korea and tensions that existed between the two of them. John F. Kennedy famously didn't like a lot of military leaders like Curtis LeMay because he felt they were moving too quickly into war. That's different, though, than being very disparaging about people who actually fought and about the soldiers who were captured. Those are qualitatively different kinds of comments, and I think that's what the critics are pointing to.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, who puts news into historical perspective for us. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Oscar-winning actress Jane Fonda is known to different generations for different reasons. These days, she's famous for her hit Netflix series, Grace and Frankie.
Do you not see me? Do I not exist? You think it's all right to ignore us? Just because she's got gray hair?
She's also known to many for her activism during the Vietnam War.
If there's anything I learned in Vietnam, it's after 4,000 years of struggle against nature and against all kinds of very powerful and professional armies, they will not surrender now. They never have in their past, and they are certainly not going to surrender now. And
Richard Well, today, Nixon's Jane Fonda is out with a new book about her activism on the issue of climate change. It's called What Can I Do? My Path from Climate Despair to Action. And Jane Fonda joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's always good to be on NPR.
Well, and this book begins with your decision back in the fall of 2019 to move to Washington, D.C. temporarily in order to protest climate change. And I want to start by asking you, what made you decide to make that move?
Well, I'd been depressed last year because even though I've made a lot of personal lifestyle type changes, you know, electric car, no more single-use plastics and so forth, I knew that I wasn't doing enough. And I didn't know what to do. When you're a celebrity, you have a platform, you know, and you want to use it responsibly. I didn't know what to do. Most of the people that were protesting in the streets were very young, Greta Thunberg and those others. And I read Naomi Klein's book called On Fire, A Burning Case for the Green New Deal. And that book, her books always roused me up, but that book made me realize that what I wanted to do was, like Greta, put my body on the line and try to help people who were not young understand the urgency of the climate crisis. We have so little time. I called up Greenpeace. I called up Annie Leonard, who directs Greenpeace USA, and told her what I wanted to do. And then we got on a conference call with Bill McKibben, the co-founder of 360.org, and Naomi Klein herself. And we decided to do it every Friday. If the young climate strikers agreed, every Friday we'd do a rally and then civil disobedience and risk arrest.
Well, and one of the things you say is that when you decided to do this, that you realized you'd have to be flying to Washington and that would actually be a problem in terms of carbon footprint. And you say you had to realize the importance of progress, not perfection. What do you mean by that? Explain that, how you decide that, in fact, you can't be perfect, but you do need to move in that direction.
Right. So you have to say, well, is it more important for me to stay home and not do these actions in Washington to not use an airplane to fly back and forth? Or is it more important to go to D.C. and do it and raise awareness? And there was 10 days when I was doing a lot of flying. And after long talks with Annie Leonard, we decided that we didn't want perfection to get in the way of good. And and so I decided it was more important. The fossil fuel executives are flying all over the world, buying off politicians and trying to convince them to not be against fossil fuels, that that's not really the problem. So if, you know, we're at a big disadvantage if they're flying all over and we can't fly to get someplace to raise awareness.
Well, and to raise awareness for what? You talk about the Green New Deal in here, and that's something that probably most of our listeners know what that is. This is a resolution proposed by people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey to address climate change and income inequality. They haven't gone anywhere yet in Congress. Republicans have mocked the Green New Deal. Do you think that that's what people should be striving for? Is that what you're striving for?
The very first thing that we need to strive for is to cut our fossil fuel emissions in half by 2030. Now, that is huge. That is a little less than 10 years. The scientists tell us that if we can't do that, we risk going beyond the tipping point where ecosystems begin to unravel beyond our control. There's nothing we can do. Number two, phase out fossil fuels to zero by mid-century, by 2050. We can't do it all at once because our economy still depends to some extent on fossil fuels. And there's a lot of workers that need to be retrained and guaranteed a good union job. You know, it can't just happen. It'll put too many people out of work. And then the Green New Deal. Why the Green New Deal? As you said, it's a resolution. It's not policies. But people are working on fleshing it out with policies as we speak. The Green New Deal is aspirational. It shows us a path forward. It calls for communities that are the most impacted, people of color, low-income communities, indigenous lands, that they be the first to receive the new jobs, the new green, sustainable jobs of the future, the first to be cleaned up. We want to demand that the fossil fuel industry be responsible for cleaning up their mess and so forth. They must not be given indemnity, which they're always demanding. So it's those three are the main demands.
Jane Fonda, you have a long history of activism. You mentioned in this book your protests against the Vietnam War. You were even arrested, not just during these protests, but also back in 1970. How do you compare the work that you're doing now to what you were doing back then?
Well, on a personal level, let me say that when you have a hit series behind your back, it's easier to do activism. better. So I didn't have that back in 1970, and that does make a difference. I think there's a maturity that has grown within the climate movement, as there has within the movement for Black lives. You know, I worked with the Black Panthers in the early 70s and helping bail political prisoners out and things like that. And it's different. There's a maturity, there's an openness, and there's also the commitment to nonviolence. And all of that has, I think, helped make the protests against white supremacy and for Black lives so very diverse and so very large. And that's wonderful to see. And I think the climate movement has changed in that it's become far more aware of climate justice, environmental justice, and the need to have justice at the forefront of any solutions that we come up with. Because, you know, the crisis that this country faces isn't just a climate crisis. It's an empathy crisis. It's a fairness crisis. It's a democracy crisis. So the solution to all of these have to address those issues as well. And that's what the Green New Deal does.
You mentioned Greta Thunberg, who is 17 years old, and you mentioned that a lot of the people who are involved in the climate change movement are very young. You are 82 years old, although many of our listeners would say you look half your age. And I would agree with that as well. But why is the climate change issue so important for you and your generation?
Well, because I'm scared. I'm also acutely aware of the fact that I'm alive in the last generation that can determine whether there's a future for human beings or not. We're it. The decisions we make will determine millions of lives and a livable future. That's a kind of a wonderful responsibility to have, which means we all have to rise up and join together and ensure that there's a living future. You know, I do have grandchildren. One of them is only a year and 1 month old. But it's not just for them that I'm doing this, because climate change is happening right now. I just got news just before we got on this call that my beloved Big Sur is being threatened with fire, that they're having to evacuate homes all along that coast highway, including Esalen. Esalen is where I made the original call to Annie Leonard and Naomi Klein when I decided to move to Washington, D.C. I have a long history with Big Sur. It's burning, not to mention the Amazon. And then last year, Australia. You know, I love these places. I love these trees, these forests, the oceans. The fact that they support our lives and they're being destroyed, I feel like the skin is being pulled off my body. You know, until I decided to do Fire Drill Fridays, I was having a hard time sleeping. Now I don't have a time because I know that I'm doing everything that I can do to make a difference. And that's what we all have to do. We have to do everything we can do. And it's different for every person. Not everybody can just pack up and move to D.C. and do these actions every week. I'm fortunate that I can afford to do it. And I was between jobs. But this is it. This will determine whether untold species will survive, including our own.
This book is called What Can I Do? My Path from Climate Despair to Action. If our listeners are wondering what they can do, what would be the first thing that you would say that they
Number
can do?
Number one, vote. Vote, 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 vote. And vote early. Get your ballots early. It's safe to vote by mail, but do it early. Get your ballots early. Mail them early. That's the most important thing, because if you know who gets in there for four more years, it's going to be very difficult.
That is activist and actor Jane Fonda, whose new book is called What Can I Do? My Path from Climate Despair to Action. Jane Fonda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on NPR. Yes.
And if you're wondering when her Netflix series Grace and Frankie will be back, Jane Fonda tells us they'll start filming in January.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Facebook is pushing back against accusations that it's a hotbed for political misinformation. The company recently announced new election rules, including a ban on new political ads within 1 week of Election Day, November 3rd. But our next guest says those well-intentioned tweaks are not nearly enough. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode, host of Recode Media. Hi, Peter.
Hi there.
So let's talk first about what Facebook says they're going to do. They're not going to allow new political ads within a week of the election. They also said they're going to take down or add context to misleading election posts. What else is the company saying they're going to do?
That's really the main thing. Facebook is trying to register voters. That seems like a good idea, and it is going to point people towards accurate information about voting. But that's about the size of it. They're sort of limited to what they can do, both because of the sort of structure of the company and the difficulty of sort of wading into actual politics.
Well, let's talk about that, because Facebook is not going to prevent campaigns from running existing ads, and those ads may contain lies, because Facebook has already said they're not going to prevent politicians from lying. Explain that.
Their argument is they don't want to prevent people from speaking freely, and they don't want to prevent political speech. And I think the best way to run the system is to allow people to say whatever they want, and then they can sort of be fact-checked after the fact. That puts a lot of onus on users and other people to do with the actual work of fact-checking.
Well, Facebook does say it will take down posts that claim you'll get COVID-19 if you vote in person. It will direct users to official election results if any candidate or campaign tries to declare victory before votes are counted. And, you know, by that, presumably they mean all the votes that are expected to be coming in by mail or absentee that might be post-election day. They're going to direct people to actual election results, but they're not going to stop someone from declaring victory?
I think the idea is if Donald Trump, for instance, were to declare victory early on before the votes have been officially tallied, they might step in and slap a warning label on there. It's even possible they might take down the post. I think there'll be in a lot of pressure not to restrict or restrain the president from speaking specifically. You know, the other problem with Facebook is just even when they are trying to sort of take down objectionable content, they have 2 billion users. That's a lot of stuff being uploaded to the site constantly. And for them to sort of figure out what's objectionable, what's something that violates a current policy takes them quite a bit of time. And in the meantime, all that information is distributed widely.
Yeah. Well, so you write, Facebook can't save us from Facebook. But what or who can? Twitter banned political ads entirely? Are you suggesting maybe that? What do you think is the solution?
I will say it's a little depressing. I don't have a good answer for this. I think these things are built in such a way that they sort of are uncontrollable at this point, unless they were to make a radical change in the way they're structured and operated, meaning that you would actually no longer have an open platform. None of the companies seems to want to actually take that on. I do think this focus on political advertising is sometimes a little misleading because paid speech is one thing on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, but you know, as much of a problem as stuff that's being distributed for free. You don't have to buy an ad to misinform someone on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. And those systems are built, again, to distribute that stuff widely.
That's Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode, host of Recode Media. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
In the months since the death of George Floyd, the black man killed by a police knee to his neck, some police departments have scaled back the use of force officers can use. But a report in Mother Jones details a company which helps other police departments craft policies that depart from the national consensus. That's a tangible thing, a document crafted by police. And this for-profit company advises allowing a wide range of use of force, which means police and cities are covered when incidents occur. Madison Pauley's piece in Mother Jones is Meet the Company That Writes the Policies That Protect Cops. The company's called Lexipol, and Madison joins us on Skype from Berkeley, California. Hi, Madison.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us, what exactly does Lexipol do?
So Lexipol is a private for-profit company that writes policy handbooks for police departments. And what they do is they guide the many decisions that police officers make on a day-to-day basis. Those decisions can range from anything from whether to pull over a car and make an arrest or fire a taser or not use force at all. What Lexipol does is they sell pre-crafted versions of these policy handbooks to police departments, which the police departments can then take and modify or change or adapt themselves or just take it in full.
And so Lexipol, as you write, has thousands of clients. And this is especially appealing to smaller police departments who just don't have the resources to rewrite or update their handbooks. So what does Lexipol do? Does it literally write the handbook?
That's exactly what it does. And like you said, it's really appealing to small departments that might not have the time or the resources to put in crafting these policy handbooks themselves. They will do that service for the smaller police departments and even some larger ones.
And we should say, though, yes, they offer the ease of having somebody craft your policy book. But Lexipol sells themselves to cities and police departments as a company that can help them avoid having to pay out on misconduct cases.
That's absolutely right. There was some research done a few years ago by a couple of scholars that looked at Lexipol's marketing, and they found that this really is how the company sells itself to police departments, saying that not only will police departments that adopt Lexipol policies have fewer lawsuits when they are sued for something that happens, they'll pay out less money. And so it's unclear how rigorously that claim has been vetted, because some of the police departments that have adopted Lexipol policies are indeed facing lawsuits over incidents that fall within the purview of that policy.
Yeah. Well, and the way Lexipol can make this promise is that they write these expansive policies on use of force. And you open your story with that of Chris Jackson. He was a black 22-year-old on probation for a drug offense in a motel in outside Lake Tahoe with a girlfriend. They were having an argument. Someone called the police. When they arrive, Chris Jackson, conscious of his probation, tries to get out a bathroom window in the back. He's hanging from the window with both hands, just his shorts on. And another police officer sees him there and shoots and kills him. No weapon visible. Now, one would think, well, shouldn't that police officer be charged for not trying some other way of bringing this young man in? But the policy written by Lexapol was used by that department, specifically two words. Can you explain?
Absolutely. The district attorney declined to charge the officer who shot Chris Jackson. The officer's name was Joshua Kling, because they decided that they couldn't prove that a reasonable officer in the same situation wouldn't have done the same thing. Even though there was no gun found at the scene, it could still be self-defense, maybe. But the way that Lexapol is involved in this case is the police department's policies have come up in a lawsuit filed by Chris Jackson's parents, challenging not only what they say was an excessive use of force by Officer Kling, but also the policy written by Lexapol and used by the South Lake Tahoe Police Department. That policy said that officers could use deadly force to protect themselves or others from any imminent threat of serious injury or death. But then it went on to say that an imminent threat could include any situation in which a reasonable officer would believe a suspect had a weapon and intended to use it. The challenge to Lexapol and in this lawsuit to the city and the officer is that this actually violates the Constitution and violates previous Supreme Court rulings on when police officers can use force.
Well, so again, just saying that an officer could use deadly force if there was an imminent threat of serious injury or death, as opposed to an immediate threat. So an imminent threat opens the door for thinking that there might be a gun when in fact that there wasn't, as opposed to seeing someone point a gun at you or believing you do, which is an immediate threat. Many departments have that policy. It's that kind of language that Lexapol writes into policies. We mentioned the National Consensus Policy on Use of Force. That's a collaboration between 11 major law enforcement groups. One of the things they require is for cops to try de-escalation techniques before using force. So where does Lexapol stand on de-escalation? And what are some of the other recommendations that Lexapol might make that maybe major police organizations don't?
The National Consensus Policy on Use of Force requires cops to try de-escalation techniques before using force if possible. That's a requirement. Lexapol, on the other hand, doesn't require police officers to try de-escalation techniques. Instead, in their use of force policy that they've just recently published, police officers should use nonviolent strategies and techniques to decrease the intensity of a situation, basically to de-escalate it. What I've learned from experts and activists is that we should pay attention to the use of the word should in this policy, because Lexapol itself and its co-founder, Bruce Priett, who is still a board member of the company, talks a lot about the use of the word should versus the word shall in the policies. And while should means this would be great if you did it, this would be good, this might even be the norm, there are exceptions and it's not mandatory to de-escalate.
Whereas if they had the word shall, it means you must. Whereas should means you could. And you mentioned Bruce Priett, who's one of the founders of the company, now on the board, a former cop who now is a lawyer, who will also offer himself up to represent police departments when they are sued. And some have pointed to this convenient, you know, loop that he will write the policy and then he will offer to, you know, for a fee, defend the police department. You know, what are you hearing from people who study police about this?
Right. So one staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union calls this a form of double dipping. Bruce Priett, he himself used to be a police officer in Orange County, and he twice beat misconduct lawsuits, according to a Los Angeles Times profile from the early 90s. After that, he went on to become a lawyer, inspired by his own defense attorney, who went on to represent one of Rodney King's assailants. So this is something that he's done a long time, defending police in many, many lawsuits, whether he's defending individual officers or the cities, especially in cases involving use of force and in cases like Chris Jackson's, where somebody ends up dead.
You mentioned Chris Jackson. You end your piece with his mother, Angela, driving to South Lake Tahoe to stay in the motel room where he was shot, trying to understand it. What's the status of their lawsuit?
The police officer involved has retired. And right now, while it looks like the argument that the officer used excessive force against Chris Jackson will likely go to trial or may go to trial, a federal judge right now is looking at the question of whether the use of force policy of the police department that was written by Lexapol is unconstitutional because of that language around imminent versus an immediate threat. And what I think all of this episode really goes to show is just how dire the consequences can be in police policy. For Chris Jackson, this policy may have been a matter of life and death.
That's Mother Jones reporter Madison Pauley. We'll link you to her article at herenow.org. Madison, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, many police departments are pulling back on force, but as to Lexapol, we reached out. While the company couldn't comment on the Jackson family lawsuit because it's still pending, it said it's confident its policies are consistent with state and federal laws. And to use of force, Lexapol says its policies do require officers to use de-escalation techniques when time and circumstances permit.
The United Kingdom officially left the European Union on January 31st. That was the beginning of a year-long transition period during which the UK and the EU were supposed to negotiate a new trade deal. That hasn't happened. The talks are at an impasse. They resume today in London with the two sides blaming each other. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson wants a deal done by an EU summit next month. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. He's on Skype from the UK. Rob, it is nice to talk to you once again, and it sounds like not much has changed.
No, it hasn't, Jeremy. You might have thought that with a global pandemic, an election, and goodness, the passage of time, that we would be saying, aha, we have absolute clarity. We know what Britain's future relationship with the European Union will be. But, oh, my goodness, we absolutely do not. Indeed, we're sort of, in many ways, where we were this time last year, except, of course, that Britain has officially left the European Union, but it's still in this transition. It leaves for real, for real, for real at the end of the year. And the question is, can the EU and the UK do a deal about their future relationship, particularly trade, between now and then?
Well, and so what is at stake exactly? Because as you say, the UK did leave officially earlier this year, but as far as most people there are concerned, not that much has actually changed.
Nope, absolutely nothing at all. It still feels absolutely the same. But of course, what will happen if Britain leaves the European Union without a deal? Now, that is something people will notice, because suddenly Britain would have the same trading relationship with the European Union, by far and away its biggest market, like Somalia or Papua New Guinea. I mean, the government here loves saying Australia, but actually we wouldn't have any free trade agreement. So in other words, you'd have things like tariffs. And so you could have effects like food becoming much more expensive in UK supermarkets, and there being long queues at our borders with Europe, particularly, of course, the old tunnel under the English Channel.
So what is the problem right now with the talks that have been going on? Why is there an impasse?
You know what? It's the same problem as if you'd asked me on the night of the referendum in 2016. I could have told you the answer. So it's essentially that the EU is saying, you know, you're not going to have a better deal outside the EU than in it, or as good a one. And on the UK side, I think it's still the British government, to the extent that it knows what it wants, would just love to have all the things it liked about the European Union, frictionless trade, but none of the things that it didn't like about, such as being in a political union. But to answer your question more specifically, there appear to be two things holding them up. I mean, one is going to seem utterly ludicrous to everyone listening, and that's the question of fishing, given what a tiny, tiny, less than 1.1% of GDP who gets to fish in British waters. And the second one is more serious. It's about the EU's fundamental concerns that somehow that the UK would be a sort of Singapore on Thames, that it would try to undercut every form of kind of regulation, and that the government would subsidize the kind of industries, high-tech industries, that it wants to succeed. And basically it wants reassurances from the UK that it won't do that, that there would be a so-called level playing field.
These are economic issues that we're talking about. And there is one thing that is very different right now than a year ago, and that is because of the coronavirus pandemic, there's been a global economic slowdown. And I see that the UK GDP was estimated to fall by a record about 20% in the last quarter. How does that change the dynamic of these talks?
It's a cracking question, Jeremy. And I think the theory is that it could work in one of two ways. So the first way is that if you're a Brexit hardliner, a real ideologue within the UK government that doesn't want, wants as distant a relationship with the EU as possible, the theory goes that maybe people like that, maybe including Johnson, think, do you know what? We could hide the bad news of a no-deal Brexit. We could hide all the kind of economic fallout from that under COVID. The second theory is the complete opposite, which is to say, why on earth would anyone in government be crazy enough to compound all of the economic fallout from COVID with the economic fallout from Brexit, a no-deal Brexit, or indeed any kind of Brexit. So you take your pick as to which theory you're more likely to believe in.
Hmm. So what do you think will happen, Rob?
God, that's an absolutely cracking question again. So it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on here. I mean, it seems to me that there are two possibilities. That the kind of dramas that we've seen, and there's been an awful lot of drama and a lot of anti-EU sort of stories in Britain's more right-wing newspapers, a lot of drama. We're not scared of going away without a deal. So it seems to me that all this drama may actually be leading up to a no deal, and this is an attempt by the UK government to make sure it gets the blame in on Brussels. It'll all be their fault. It'll all be the fault of the European Union. Or, as you know, quite often when there's all this sort of drama, it's a prelude, in fact, to an agreement being reached. And both sides say, oh, goodness gracious, that was difficult for 1 minute there. Mm-hmm. We thought it was all going to break down, but we got there. I genuinely don't know. And here's the really interesting thing. A lot of people, a lot of British politicians, they don't know what Boris Johnson thinks, but even he doesn't know.
That is the BBC's Rob Watson. And as you can hear there, Brexit drama continues and they still haven't figured it out exactly. Rob, thank you.
Thank you. And keep in touch, obviously.
Robin, we can keep on keeping in touch with Rob, but he does tend to tell us the same thing, which is that they haven't figured it out over there.
Quite. Don't tell him that.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.